Today, we give you a break from politics to talk about the ups and downs of Britain's most famous chef, Jamie Oliver, whose cookbooks will be used by millions for Christmas dinner next week, but whose restaurant business collapsed this year. And questions around the human cost of our mobile phone supply chain. Tell me about the first time you ever met Jamie Oliver.
Oh.
Can't remember it.
I can't remember. That's terrible,
Jamie,
isn't it?
Jamie who? Anna Beryl is the acting deputy editor of The Guardian's Feast magazine, but she used to work with that very famous Jamie, Jamie Oliver, on his self-titled food mag.
Jamie would write a feature for us every month, a recipe feature. In the planning meetings, that's where you saw him at his, what I think, naked chef best. There wasn't an ego there. He knows his food. Listening to him come up on the spot with ideas for recipes is really impressive and inspiring, and you can see how he's got to where he did.
Where he got to was unimaginable success. A national treasure who we all feel on first name terms with. He was on the telly again this week.
I've been cooking Christmas for my family for more than 20 years now. First, the turkey, and I'll show you my tricks for making it extra juicy and tasty.
Proper Lady Gaga, ready for the party.
But Jamie's star status has fallen. That magazine where Anna was deputy editor is long gone. And then there's his restaurant business.
I lost my restaurants in the UK this year, which was, yeah, really tough. 13 years, really hard work. Ran out of money, ran out of everything.
When it went into administration in May, more than 1,000 people lost their jobs.
Today, from the south coast through to Scotland, the close signs went up.
All but three of his 25 restaurants, including the London branch of his celebrated social enterprise, 15, shut down.
Jamie Oliver has proved once again it takes more than having a famous name over the door and being able to cook to make a success of the restaurant business.
Then last week, the other branch of 15, this one a franchise in his name in Cornwall, also closed. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what's going on with Jamie Oliver? Believe it or not, there was a time when no one had ever heard of Jamie Oliver.
You all right, man?
Yeah, good to see you.
Thanks for coming.
No worries, not too late, am I?
No, we're cracking away, mate. Most of it's done.
Where did he come from?
He's got quite a foodie background. His parents owned a pub in Essex.
I don't like brown bread. My mum always tried to get me on it, but I don't like it at all.
And he used to work there for pocket money.
All Jamie's friends used to work at the pub, and Trevor used to beat them all into submission. Not literally, metaphorically.
Then he went to catering college, and where he was discovered, as it were, was at the River Cafe.
Right, we've got garlic here with some olive oil.
The BBC, I believe, were doing a documentary, Christmas at the River Cafe.
They're really hot.
And I think they discovered that he could talk in a way that's an editor's dream, really.
And I just plunked that in the table, let them help themselves. Lovely.
Short to the point, getting on with his cooking.
He wasn't a traditional chef.
Not a traditional chef at all. The Naked Chef was just such a game changer for cooking programmes.
Naked's what I call my way of cooking. What I cook in the restaurant isn't what I cook at home.
I think he really changed the way we cook and who is cooking. I mean, it inspired a whole generation of men to get in the kitchen.
I suppose you could say it's stripping down the recipe to its bare essentials.
And I think it was really peak Britpop. He was, you know, sliding down the banisters to open door to his mates or on his scooter.
I'm going to cook a Thai green curry, which is pretty appropriate, really, because we're going to get a little bit bevved up tonight.
The cooking was so casual, and he was adding a dollop of this, a bit of that, you know.
Tearing his herbs.
Exactly. He was so hands-on. He was tossing his salad with his fingers, poking stuff into his meat and what have you. And he
poking
really...
what stuff into his meat?
Like herbs, garlic, anchovies, nothing nefarious. And he really stripped the food down and made you feel like anyone could cook the dishes.
Just going to whack it in the oven for about 10 minutes so it's slightly golden.
And at the start, his then-girlfriend Jules would make appearances in The Naked Chef.
Must be fantastic having a boyfriend who can cook.
Can you tell that to my girlfriend? She just thinks I'm a bit strange.
Now his wife, and they have 5 kids, and I think that really plays into his whole image. I mean, he's a family man.
And I have 2 little helpers today. What's your name?
Daisy. Poppy.
They appear on his Instagram account. He almost lives this idyllic life that I think people want to play into a little bit.
So after The Naked Chef, we got Jamie's Kitchen.
Yes.
When he was training up 15 disadvantaged youths.
Yes.
And I guess this was the arrival of Jamie Oliver, the campaigner.
My name is Jamie Oliver. I'm here to say I want to talk about Food Revolution Day. Half the world is starving with too little to eat, and the other half died from being a beast.
He became political very early on, I think. Jamie's Kitchen happened, what, 3 years or so after The Naked Chef?
If you think that you've got that ingression inside of you to answer back to chefs, forget it. No paycheck, P45 time, mate.
And I also think that's probably played into why he can be perceived as quite a divisive character.
And that began as a television programme. What happened with it?
The TV series had the Restaurant 15, which was based in Clerkenwell, at the heart, where he trained 15 apprentices, young people from difficult backgrounds, and he trained them as chefs.
Whilst I just course I was just running the streets and just doing silliness, when I've got something to do, it's like it's changed my life around.
The only thing I had in common with most of those kids was that I had a rough time at school.
What was great is that he took them to Producer's Farm, so it didn't feel like a stunt for TV. He really kind of got them to understand about ingredients. And I mean, when they opened, they were book solid for months. And a lot of the people that took part in that scheme are chefs today. People like Guardian Feast, Anna Jones went through 15.
Then on the top, you've got the squash, which kind of brings it all together. It's that
17
sweetness.
Years later, after they closed the door, I think they had about 150 or so graduates that had been through the programme. I think 15 is going to be a big part of his legacy because it's such an amazing project.
It was the first of a lot of campaigns. I mean, yes. The one that I remember most of all are Turkey Twizzlers.
Yes, which I think it remains a long-standing Jamie put down, really.
Kids in England today know what a Turkey Twizzler is more than a chicken breast.
That was a campaign to ban junk food and processed food from school canteens. And he also pressured the government to commit new funds to improve school food.
When Jamie met Tony at number 10 this morning, the national scandal of school dinners became the heart of election policy.
He received a bit of flack during that process for coming across as being patronising.
What have I done here?
Just mozzarella and a bit of pepper.
Mozzarella? I never seen no mozzarella.
Mozzarella.
And there was resistance from parents. You know, no one's going to forget those images of parents handing food through the school gates to their kids.
You've reminded me of those images of the mums and maybe the odd dad pushing the burgers through the gates. And am I right in thinking that he calls someone a big old scrubber?
Yes, on Top Gear. That was in reference to Julie Critchlow, who defiantly was passing burgers and other junk food through the gates of the school.
The elusive Mr. Oliver, it's nice to meet you at last.
I'm here.
I would like an apology off you for calling me a big fat scrubber on Top Gear.
He did apologise to her later and I think she reluctantly accepted the apology.
Surely the school food revolution was a good thing. They'd been spending pennies on kids' meals, and that led to a financial boost of hundreds of millions of pounds.
So we will put another 240 million over and above the 220. And
that's mega. You've been incredible.
It's unbelievably impressive and was part of the reason that I wanted to go and work for the company. I started at the magazine at an interesting time because it had just moved over to Hearst. So it was not being published internally anymore. So I joined Jamie Magazine as deputy editor in 2016.
Did you learn through working for his magazine things about Jamie Oliver, the person, and also about his business more widely?
He's not guarded at all. I mean, what you see on TV is what he's like, which I think is quite rare. One of the great things about Jamie is that he does like to support young chefs, young food writers. You genuinely think he does believe in the power of food to change things.
I profoundly believe that the power of food has a primal place in our homes.
But you did get the sense that at this time, the business had exploded so much. How can one person be on top of everything and involved in everything?
As we know, Jamie Oliver is not just about the hit television series, the campaigning, the magazine, the best-selling recipe books, or even just the restaurants. When it comes to food, Jamie is everywhere. In 2000, he became the face of Sainsbury's.
Richie boy, I'm just going to go down to Sainsbury's, get some munchies. What do you want?
Some pasta salad or something.
Guardian business writer Sarah Butler says the relationship wasn't always harmonious.
They'd had a few kind of mini fallings out when he was doing some of his campaigning around the chicken industry.
We've got fluffy chicks, we've got free-range birds, we've got intensively reared broiler chickens, we've got battery hens.
He talked about how were chickens raised, and he wanted Sainsbury's to come on his programme, and they didn't, and he criticised them for that. So there was various things where his campaigning seemed to grate against being the face of the supermarket.
Then there was a cooking school, Recipes, and with it, branded garlic crushers and chopping boards.
Me and Tfal have been working together for 16 years and we've developed some of the most beautiful pans out there.
And then there was Jamie at Home, which was a kind of Tupperware style party business. So it was like...
Tupperware style party business?
You know, like, so cookware, things like pans and crockery or whatever.
What, like the Avon woman?
Yeah, kind of.
And in 2008, he opened the first Jamie's Italian in Oxford.
People were queuing around the block to go to this place. They couldn't really open them fast enough for demand.
He expanded the chain rapidly, and critics say that's when the quality and consistency of the food went down.
How involved personally was he with his business?
My understanding is that with the Jamie's Italian, it was a business that was run quite separately, and he might have thoughts on the menu and so on, but it's not like he would be cooking in any of the kitchens.
I mean, do you think he spread himself too thin?
I think there's definitely an argument for that. There was, you know, a whole plethora of small restaurant groups that he tried to run. There was Barbacoa, which was a kind of barbecue style restaurant. There was Jamie's Diner, which was a kind of American style thing. There was Jamie's Deli. There was Union Jack's, which I think was a cafe style thing. So he's previously said that 40% of his business ideas fail.
What's his net worth?
It's around 240 million.
Blimey. He got very rich. But it's not all been success for Jamie Oliver. Tell us what happened in May this year.
Jamie's restaurant empire, which included Jamie's Italian and the London 15 restaurant, went into administration.
When Jamie's Italian opened over a decade ago, the landscape was, of course, entirely different.
In the end, his dining empire has been undermined by a shift away from outlets like this.
All of his restaurants, bar three in the UK, are closed.
How many times have you sort of said to 1,400 people, the show's over?
It was the most awful experience of my life.
Had they seen that coming?
All the restaurants have been having difficulties for a number of years. In 2017, they closed six restaurants of Jamie's Italian. And then the following year, they closed about another 12.
I was very naive at the time. I was good at running one restaurant. But I wouldn't call myself a businessman.
And he had put more than 20 million into the business to try and keep it afloat.
I open lots of big restaurants, and I think people like smaller, medium-sized restaurants, and that's, you kind of have these big cathedrals that you can't fill.
You know, suppliers were owed millions of pounds.
You mentioned staff and suppliers. I mean, we've spoken to a couple of people off the record who were involved in his restaurants as suppliers, and they said what happened was absolutely devastating for them.
What happens when a business goes into administration is that the administrators sell off whatever assets they can find to pay off the debts. So if you're the bank, you've probably got secured debt, so you will be paid first. But the small suppliers, people providing food and so on, they're at the bottom of the list.
So, Will, what happens now? When's the end?
We will try and sell what we can from here and from the other sites across the country. But, you know, I don't think our expectations are set that high in terms of what we're going to realise.
At the peak, he had more than 40 restaurants. And actually, even today, there are three Jamie's branded restaurants still operating in the UK. They're all in Gatwick Airport.
At Gatwick, we've got proper cooking. You know, we're not reheating stuff in microwaves.
He also franchised out his name. So those were part of this franchise business.
We haven't just done this for a business opportunity. We haven't just done this for a laugh. Hopefully, we're going to succeed.
And in fact, another restaurant he didn't directly run, but was part of his brand, 15 in Cornwall, shut down last week. He said in a statement he was surprised by its closure, which suggested he didn't know it was happening. And I know that is different because it's a not-for-profit being run by a charity, But it did make me think that when your name is being used by another organisation, how do you guarantee the quality?
Well, that's all in a franchise agreement. So while they pay for the right to use the name, there are certain limits and controls on, you know, how the restaurant will look, what the food's going to be in there, what the menu might be.
But did everything that he ran himself collapse?
That's right, yeah.
Running a restaurant, especially at that mid-market level, seems incredibly tough. How has it become so competitive?
Private equity investors have pumped a lot of money into the casual dining sector because it was seen to be a growth industry at a time when retail was struggling. If you just look at the Italian sector, you've had Carluccio's, Strada, Prezzo, Ask Pizza, Zizzi, a huge amount of competition just in that Italian area, never mind sort of Oaxaca or other kind of food types that were competing for the same pound. They're coming under pressure, and a number of chains, they've had to close site. The whole industry has come under pressure.
What's happening in the industry that's made them come under pressure?
So there's a combination of factors. Business rates have gone up. The minimum wage has risen because of the fall in the value of the pound since the Brexit vote. A lot of ingredients and other things that have to be bought from abroad, the cost of buying those has gone up.
And for all those reasons, I was pretty surprised to read that he's now opening another chain that's mid-range.
When I was talking about the two parts to his restaurant empire, you had the bit that he ran himself and that was all closed. And then you have the franchise. And this new concept is just another kind of part of that portfolio. And they will all be overseas, from what I understand.
So it's called Jamie, but it's not really Jamie. Has anything changed in the way he does things?
He does seem to have wanted to make a change, and he's announced that his business will become a B Corp. B Corp is a special category of business where social impact and environmental issues are supposed to rank equally with profits. And you have to go through a whole process of accreditation where people examine the way that your business is operating in order to be registered as one. And so that's obviously him trying to show that he wants to do business in a different way.
Anna, we have Jamie, the great chef and campaigner, and Sarah has told us about Jamie as a business person. Why hasn't he been able to run more successful restaurant businesses?
I feel that there is a bit of a disconnect within the business. I feel that you have Jamie's recipes that stand the test of time and you have his campaigns. And then you have the restaurant side of it and these partnerships with people like Shell. And I think that was potentially the problem, that there was no join up.
There's so many of you, millions of you, every single week going around the country who are trying to grab food on the go, and we want to do it better.
You mentioned the join up with Shell, but you know, I knew nothing about this until the other day when I walked into a petrol station. I'm like, I don't want to be patronising about it. You know, we all love a ginsters, or I occasionally love a ginsters, but petrol stations aren't famed for their quality food.
Now, food on the go has always been kind of related with fast food, junk food. You know, it's been in need of a little pushing up.
I mean, I bought one of them, lovely looking wrap with roasted vegetables. And honestly, it was like eating a rubber ball. It was so tasteless. Isn't it damaging for his brand to be associated with that?
Yeah.
Why is he doing it?
I honestly don't know. It kind of screams a little bit of what happened with Jamie's Italian. I mean, if the quality's not there, you're just damaging your brand.
So what's next for him?
Well, his business is now committed to halving childhood obesity by 2030. And I hope that Jamie continues to campaign in this way, because that's the reason that I wanted to work for him. And I'm sure others did too.
That was Anna Beryl, who is acting deputy editor of Feast magazine, and business writer Sarah Butler. Do go to the website to read their work. Coming up, Annie Kelly on the Congolese cobalt miners taking tech giants to court. You're probably using a smartphone right now. But how much do you know about cobalt? It's a key material in the makeup of your phone, and its supply chain is now being challenged in a landmark legal case pitting Congolese families against tech giants. The Guardian and Observer's Annie Kelly explains.
So many people may not have even heard of cobalt, but cobalt is essential to power any rechargeable lithium battery that's used in millions of products sold around the world every year. So without cobalt, we couldn't recharge our smartphones, we couldn't recharge our computers, and we couldn't power any electric cars. Our insatiable demand for cobalt has tripled in the past 5 years, and it's expected to double again by the end of 2020. And what's extraordinary is that more than 60% of the world's cobalt originates in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is one of the poorest and most unstable countries in the world. The extraction of cobalt from the DRC has been linked to really egregious human rights abuses, corruption, environmental destruction, but most damningly, it has been linked to child labour. There are two ways that cobalt is extracted from the ground in the DRC, through the use of large industrial equipment in big mines owned by multinational companies, but there's also a lot of artisanal mining, which is where local people are digging for cobalt using very primitive tools or even their hands, and they're then selling that cobalt on, and that cobalt is getting mixed up into the global supply chains. This is an incredibly opaque and complicated supply chain, and nobody has ever really faced any proper legal scrutiny about how cobalt is being mined and where it's going and who is profiting from it. What is really important about this case is for the first time, Apple, Dell, Microsoft, Google and Tesla are being directly linked to the deaths and injuries of children because the families are alleging that these deaths and injuries happened in mines which are directly in the supply chain of these companies. In the court documents, the Congolese families describe, in really heartbreaking detail, how their children were driven by extreme poverty to seek work in these large mining sites. And they claim that they were paid as little as £1.50 a day for really dangerous, back-breaking work, digging for cobalt rocks, often with their hands, in these very dark underground tunnels. One plaintiff in the case, who is named as Jane Doe One, says in the court papers her nephew was forced to seek work in the cobalt mines when he was a very small child. Then in April 2018, he was working in a mine operated by Komoto Copper Company, which is owned and controlled by the big UK mining company Glencore. He was working underground in a tunnel, digging for cobalt rocks, when the tunnel collapsed on top of him and he was buried alive. His family rushed to the mine, but they say that they never, ever recovered his body. The lawsuit also names as plaintiffs children themselves who were really seriously injured or paralysed whilst working in cobalt mines. So these are really, really serious accusations that the company are facing. One of the big central allegations in the lawsuit is that all of the defendants, so that's Apple, Google, Dell, Microsoft and Tesla, were all aware and had specific knowledge that the cobalt that they use in their products is linked to child labour that is performed in such dangerous conditions. And so their lawsuit argues that they are complicit in the forced labour of their children and aided and abetted their deaths by profiting from dangerous conditions that ultimately led to their deaths and injuries. Crucially, the court papers argue that all of these companies have the authority and the resources to supervise and regulate their cobalt supply chains, and that their inability to do so contributed directly to the death of these children. This case is really important for a number of reasons. The first is that it's the first time that any big tech company is going to be scrutinised over its supply chain links to cobalt. The second is that it's going to be an opportunity for those voices at the very bottom of this huge global supply chain to be heard in a court of law for the first time. And lastly, this lawsuit is also really important because it's part of a new wave of so-called strategic litigation, which is being launched in countries, especially like the United States, which is trying to compel companies to take the moral imperative and police their own supply chain. Whatever the outcome, it's really important for issues like this to be tried before a court.
That was Annie Kelly. All of the defendants to the claim have been approached for comment. Glencore has said that it does not tolerate any form of child, forced or compulsory labour at any of its sites. Do follow the case and read Annie's Modern Day Slavery in Focus series on the website. That's it for today. My thanks to Anna Beryl, Sarah Butler and Annie Kelly. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore, Rose Del Arabiti and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.